Okay, guys, let's carry on. So I hope that was a fun way of getting to know Mark just a little bit better. And if you look at your handout, we're going to have a quick think of trying to put that all together. So it is really important to know what's in Mark's gospel and to know where it comes. And then as you begin to think about that, it was obvious, maybe even as you're having discussions in your little groups, you're thinking, well, would Mark put it there? Why would he put it there? Why do it in that order? Especially when maybe you saw similar things or, you know, wanting to know why you did that before that. So it's key. Clearly, Mark has thought about how to put his account together. He hasn't just sat down, scratched his head and randomly thought of all the different things that happened and splurged them out on a piece of paper. So it's really good to try and think through, well, why did he write it as he did? Why did he put things in this order? What was his thinking behind it? And that's the kind of thing you do and work out by doing what you've just been doing. You think about it, you scratch your head, you think, why did he do that? But it's really helpful to do that more and more. And so through this year, I'm sure we will slowly see pennies drop and it'll all come together and we'll realise why Mark did it. But really helpful at the beginning of a year, just to get the beginnings of an overview, begin to put it together so that we can see how Mark has set it all up and therefore what he's trying to do as we go through different parts of Mark's gospel. Hopefully it'll give us great confidence. It really helps to lead a study when you know the kind of, well, it's the context of the whole book. Why this is coming here, why this is coming early in the next few weeks, and what is it that we're going to be waiting a bit later for. And it helps a lot with questions, because often people in our groups have never really thought about where stuff comes in Mark's gospel. So that if we can help to say, ah, well, hang on, great question, but it's later, or Mark's addressing this issue now, it will help you an awful lot as you go through the year. So that's our aim. We're going to try and think a little bit about that. Why is it important? You won't have to use your imagination, but imagine a couple of RML studies. And the first one, you're in Mark chapter 2, and Jesus says to the paralyzed man, I say to you, rise up, pick up your bed, and go home. And then just as you end, one of your group members says, that is so encouraging. I'm off to see my friend in hospital. She's really ill. I'm going to give her that word from the Lord. Now, clearly, you'd hope they wouldn't do that. But then you've got to say, well, let's say they were genuine. They really think that's a word for them, that Jesus can heal the sick today. What are you going to say? How are you going to help? And structure will help you to know how to respond to that issue. Or a later one. So you get to chapter 8 and he strictly charged them to tell no one about him. And then one of your group members says, that is such a relief. they say, you know, there is proof. Isn't it? There are times when we really should just keep quiet about Jesus. And obviously your alarm bells are ringing, you're thinking, disaster. So, and again, what are you going to say? Well, structure will help. So hopefully as we go through, we'll get to the end of that. And so let's make a start. And we're going to think just really about reading a book. So I know it's the obvious thing. I don't know, Sachi, that story about Simpa yesterday with the prunes, was that actually true? That's actually true. But that was a classic example of how not to use a book. And we are coming into RML, I think, with a lot of us not realising, especially our group members, we have in our hands a book. If nothing else, it is a piece of literature. And Mark wants us to read it like that. Even as Christians, we sometimes think it's in the Bible. That's just what it says. And we don't read it properly. And if we did, we'd be helped an awful lot. And we'd think, Mark has thought about this in the same way that other novelists have. So, just to give us an introduction, this summer, my novel of the year was Ian McEwan's Sweet Tooth. You don't need to have read it. In fact, it'll help if you haven't. Lots of people are new are reading it. And so I thought, okay, I was in the summer, I will read it. And I think this just proves a point. So I'm going to read you the first paragraph. Listen carefully. You do actually know how to read. I think almost we're better readers when we don't read the Bible because we kind of know what we're meant to be doing. But let me read it and let's just see what you think by the end. So chapter 1. My name is Serena Froome, rhymes with plume. And almost 40 years ago, I was sent on a secret mission for the British Security Service. I didn't return safely. Within 18 months of joining, I was sacked, having disgraced myself and ruined my lover, though he certainly had a hand in his own undoing. And then in the very next paragraph, she goes, if you like, back to the beginning. But right up front, the author has given us that paragraph. and you've read it first, you know, when you opened it and thought, what's the book about? You've read that paragraph and he's told you that, and you know it as you read on. And it turns out actually that that is actually a summary of the whole book, you soon discover. So quite early on, the British Secret Service thing kind of comes into play and you realise he's going to do that. You don't actually find out, but you know there's going to be this lover. That's clearly a key part. Her lover, he had a hand in his own undoing. Who is this lover? And you find out, it's not until about halfway through, but you kind of read the first half knowing you've got to find out who this lover is. And then this disgrace, this undoing. So you're reading it, and you know, you kind of have been told that, but it actually doesn't happen until the very end. But the whole point is, you read it knowing that, and the author has desired for you to have that in your mind and to see how it works through. And then, I don't think it's a great book. The end is a very, very clever twist, which almost makes it worthwhile. That's partly why he told you up front what's going to happen. But obviously it shaped how you read the book. And you would do that. That's not terribly clever. But it's a shame we don't do that for the Bible and for Mark's Gospel. So let's, well, it's on the sheet, isn't it? That first sentence. So don't turn in your Bible. Just look at that first sentence. And many of us will be very familiar with it. But let's imagine we just did with Mark what I just did with Ian McEwan. Someone read to you, which may well be how someone first heard it, that first sentence. And why don't you just, in twos and threes, maybe with a pair, make observations on that sentence, things you notice, things you think Mark wants you to notice. Just from the first sentence of his book. I'll give you a couple of minutes to do that. Okay, let me interrupt. And why don't you, anyone got a few observations or comments, or having read that sentence, things you now think, okay, as I read on, I need to know what Mark means by that. Anyone want to help us? Caroline?
Well, so, I mean, we've just been through what the words, each word mean, and so Jesus being God saves, and Christ the anointed, and the Son of God being from Psalm 2, where it's the one anointed by God and chosen by God, it tells us that it's the story of that guy who's been chosen by God and is going to save.
Okay, so very simply, first of all, right at the beginning, it's about this person. It's something about a person. So this is a piece of literature that wants to tell you about Jesus. So you're thinking, that's what this book is about, Jesus. Okay? And anyone develop more? Yep.
So I think we always think of the word gospel as meaning a book. But if it okay. actually means proclamation, then actually it's more about this news than it is about the natural book.
Okay. So again, it's good news, momentous news, important news. So Mark, you're getting something has landed that's telling you, I have good news, presumably for you. But it's about this person. So this person, Jesus, a historical figure, you may have heard of him, you know, in original readers a few decades before, but that person matters for you because it's good news, okay? Any more? Just developing what we've heard already, yeah?
I think we wonder, you'd wonder how Mark was going to show us that Jesus is the Son of God.
Okay. So it's worth saying, isn't it, that he's making claims for this Jesus, Christ and Son of God. I mean, we'll think about it later this afternoon in Slobs, I'm sure you know already, both of which are titles for God's King, and some readers would be very aware that is a massive claim to make in his first line, that this Jesus is good news, and it's because of who he is the Christ, the Son of God, both of which really mean essentially the same thing, that God's King that's been promised for centuries. I want to tell you it was Jesus, which is quite a start to a gospel. And as you know, the very next verse, for maybe those who aren't familiar with that Old Testament, he says, as it says in Isaiah, he says, let me just show you straight away. I know this is what I'm talking about. Jesus is that King. Problem is, when so many read it, maybe on the welcome party, I chat to one person, oh, I know, Mark, I've done it before. It's no one said it this Wednesday, I've had it before, though. It's for the kids, Sunday school. So easy to read. I think it sounds like the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Actually, that just washes over people completely. It's what you expect somehow in the Bible, in Mark's gospel. But as we teach it, we're trying to say, no, let's slow down and stop. That's the most astonishing claim. Just imagine if there was a lottery and the jackpot was this. In a week's time, the jackpot was £100 million. And the initial sentence says, I'm going to tell you what the numbers are the next Saturday. But there's a catch. This is a jackpot where a ticket costs you £10,000. But I'm telling you, I'm giving you the numbers for next Saturday. You go and buy a ticket. It'll cost you 10,000, but it's for sure 100 million will be yours next Saturday. Now, let's just think, you don't think this is a spoof email. You read that from something you might think is a reputable source. Well, just imagine how you're going to read on. You're going to maybe be sceptical. You're going to realise that's a massive claim. But you're going to say to me, show me that. Prove that to me. And if you're going to make me act in what is a very costly way, you are really going to have to convince me. And almost that's what Mark is doing. He says, I've got good news for you. And it is this astonishing claim that Jesus is the Christ. So that's how he starts. And that's going to be in our minds as we get going straight away. Now that is, if you like, the structure of the whole book. I want to show you Jesus. That helps us with Mark chapter 2, verse 11. I say to you, rise up, pick up your bed and go home. So the first thing we'll say, if someone makes a comment like we'll say earlier, we'll say, well, first of all, we say, well, what does this show us about Jesus? Don't we? So just doing Mark 1, verse 1 has shown us we're thinking it's about Jesus. It's good news for us, no doubt about it. That's what Mark is saying. But it's not, if you like, first of all about us, it's about Jesus. So we work out what it means about Jesus, then we work out what it means about us. And that'll help us so many times. There's so many questions in Mark that people throw in. We get a bit thrown by, just think, what is this first they're referring to? Show us about Jesus and start there. So there's that claim at the beginning of the gospel, and then we read on and we think, okay, Mark, show me, persuade me, convince me. And as you know, we meet lots of characters in Mark's gospel, and we quickly associate with the disciples, you know, nice bunch, slightly dim, and they're on this voyage of discovery. But we're clearly associating with them. They see the things that Mark shows us, so they see what we see, and we're kind of with them. And obviously as it gets going, this dimness gets a bit more serious, and it's clearly a little bit obstinate, but we're kind of with them. We want to think, well, Mark's made this astonishing claim, but who's going to realise it? So demons notice, claims are made by them, but Jesus says, no, keep quiet. Well, we want to see the disciples. And as you know, we get to Mark 8:29, and at last, one of the human characters gets what we've been let in on all along and tells us that Jesus is the Christ. That key word. Remember, Mark told us that at the beginning. We kind of knew it, but needed to be shown it. And now someone in the account has got it. Jesus is the Christ. So then, of course, we think, well, does that mean Son of God? And we read on and we look for Son of God. And again, we see a number of places it's referred to by Jesus himself, by, again, demons, by others. But it doesn't come until Mark 15:39. And the surprise maybe is we might have thought, well, we'll wait for the disciples to say that. But the first person that says it is this centurion. So if you like on the sheet here, you could draw an arrow from Christ to Christ, Son of God to Son of God. It's as if Mark has shown, I want people to realise this. And by the end, they have. We've had Christ and Son of God. So you might think, well, there's an initial suggestion for a structure to our account, if you like. Gospel of two halves. And I don't just mean that in an obvious way. Every book you could split into two halves. It looks like Mark has meaningfully given us two little markers. But you may well be sitting there thinking, hang on. You've got more work to persuade me of that. But I say that's an initial idea. But we immediately see more things. We see the blindness of the man in chapter 8, the trees walking. We get that miracle before Peter sees it. So clearly Mark is highlighting, here's a moment of insight, of perception, of understanding. And if you remember in chapter 15, just before that final bit on the cross, the religious leaders talk about seeing and believing. They say to Christ, get off the cross and we'll see and believe. But then we see that the centurion saw him at the cross and said, Son of God. So we can see there are more links. But again, you might think, okay, more reasons, but I want you to pursue this. So this is what we do in any theory we might be coming up with as we study the Bible. We begin to see a link. And so we think, okay, I'm going to run with it for a bit and see if there's anything that confirms it. So if you turn onto that table you've got on the next page, and I want us to see, are there more links? Is Mark clearly trying to draw together the beginning, the middle, and the end? So we've got three columns there, and in our little twos and threes or fours, we're going to see what connections we can see maybe Mark makes. Here we are going to do a little bit, you know what they say, but we are looking for particular maybe markers he is putting in. So it will be individual words. Don't worry too much about what they're doing in the story, but just things which Mark seems to be putting up as a flag so that we think, oh look, all these things are coming together again. So when you start with Mark 1 and then particularly Mark 15, 33 to 41, just start with those two sections, see any connections, and then if you have time, see if any of those also come in the middle. And then you could also see if there are any in the first and the second and the second and the third. But start with Mark 1 and Mark 15 and see if you can find connections or links that Mark makes between the two. Okay, this group over here has confidently declared that they have found them all. So we will see. I hope, even before we go into it, that you obviously realise that it's a huge amount of correspondence between these passages, and we could think for ages of what all they all mean. But Mark is clearly trying to do something. But let's help each other by saying some of the things that we saw. So let's first start with Mark 1, and then, if you like, 15, the bit about the cross. Who can just shout out some clear connections?
It's the same Jesus. He's from the same place.
Go on.
From Nazareth.
Thank you. Nazareth is mentioned twice there and very rarely elsewhere. Yep.
Son of God.
Son of God comes where?
The first verse. Yeah. And the centurion.
Exactly. So we've kind of mentioned that. And then, as you know, the beloved son comes in the transfiguration as well. So a link there. Yep.
Elijah
gets a mention, the name certainly, in, again, all three. Thank you. Tim?
Kingdom of God is in all three.
Yes, Kingdom of God. Yes, thank you.
Anointing.
Anointing.
In Mark 1 and then later when Mary comes to anoint
at the tomb. Yep, thank you.
Miraculous Good. Signs in the sky.
Go on.
So, like, in... chapter 1, the sky opens, God proclaims. In chapter 2, the sky opens, and when Jesus dies, it's covered in darkness.
Okay, so there's stuff going on in the sky in all three. Yeah, there's another one quite relate close to that
there
one.
Twice a voice coming down from heaven, and okay. Once Jesus addressing to heaven.
Okay, so there's the voice of the Father, and then Jesus' voice crying out, the third one. Yep. Naomi. Torn, brilliant. Yeah, well spotted. So torn happens both beginning and end. Yeah,
Tim.
Angel.
Start
and the end. Thank you. How are we doing, more? Can you mention them?
I've got some angels ministering at the beginning and women ministering.
The ministering, brilliant. So they come start and end. Any more?
We discussed rising.
Go on.
Rising from the dead at the end and in the middle mention, but then also kind of the baptism and
okay.
Rising.
So there's some that are really strong between the first and the second, the second and the third, and you might see something. Now, some of them I hope you see are clearly very convincing. They are definite. Some of the other ones you might think, if it was just them, I might be hesitant, but with all the others, it kind of adds cumulatively. But are definitely, so maybe we could pick out some of those, the rising, the second and the third. Any others? Well, either in all three, or first and second, second and third. Yep.
You mentioned Elijah, but just looking at John comes, he was predicted in the Old Testament. Then in chapter 8 and 9, Jesus says Elijah must come first, and then the Son of Man must suffer.
Yep.
At the end, he does suffer. And
yes, so the Old Testament witness is clear between, so in the first and the second, and implied in the third. Yep. Implied in the third, because Jesus quotes from the Old Testament as he dies. So again, this is something the Old Testament has spoken about. Pardon?
Satan is in the first and the middle.
Yeah, I think it's quite exciting. He's in the first, he's in the second, but he's not in the third. Anyway.
We do asymmetries.
No, we won't do that, Johnny, but thank you.
Well, like,
go on.
God's pleased with Jesus,
yeah.
But God's forsaken him.
Okay, so yeah, something like that. So the relationship between the Father and the Son, if you like, which exactly is contrasted, but it's there in both. That is important, and in the middle one. But that's really, so I think there are a few like that where, and that's the one with Satan, I think, as well. So something is there, they're not, and you can't help once you've started to think, well, interesting. How do I work that out? Yep, any more?
White clothes.
White clothes, brilliant. Tell us what those were.
Transfiguration is very white clothes.
Yep.
And the man at the tomb is white clothes.
So dazzling bright white. Brilliant. And a lot of these, although we can't see it now because we just looked at the beginning and the end, they don't appear anywhere else. So they would, we'd notice it more, if you like, as you were reading it through. Can we keep going? Or we,
I think we said that
said Nazareth, but I don't think we quite mentioned Galilee, which gets a reference.
Again, that's true. So I think that's right. So there's a lot of Galilee in the first half of the Gospel, but it does striking that it comes back at the end to kind of make the link. Yeah.
With baptism and prediction of death and then death at the end. So
okay, so if the baptism is associating with sinners in a sense, maybe that's another connection between them.
Arrested, Tim? John the Baptist is arrested at the beginning and Jesus is in custody at the end.
Okay. Okay, so here we go to ones you might want to debate at over coffee. But now, it'd be quite exciting. We could talk about a lot of those because a lot of them have a lot of significance. Some of them, Mark is making a link between words he is using clearly, just if like to make it obvious. But often to a lot of them as well, there is significance. And a lot of them, there's some reason in the Old Testament he's wanted to do that. Like the torn, Isaiah 64, God said when he was come, the heavens would be rendered and torn. And then Mark tells us twice that happens. So there's lots to it. But for now, I just wanted to think, well, clearly, therefore, it's not just two halves. Mark clearly wants us to think, first half, until chapter 8, that little section 8, beginning of 9, and then the end. That clearly is meant to be the way that we shape our thinking about Mark's gospel. Okay, so once that's in place, and that's fairly clear, we begin to think, but why has he done that? We're not just meant to notice it and think, well, there are two halves. What's his purpose behind it? And so we just keep thinking along the lines we have. I already mentioned the blind man and the seeing and believing at the cross. And then you can't help but notice, of course, there's a second healing of the blind man in Mark. And by the time you've got to chapter 10, Mark is very selective. He edits his material. We don't need to be told that Jesus can heal blind people. We know he can do that. Virtually every other miracle Jesus does once. And once he's done it, we know that. So it's striking when we notice in chapter 10 at the end, we get another healing of a blind miracle. And there's lots more, isn't there? Because the one in chapter 8 is that two-stage. I see them and you think, well, what's that all about? But then this time, the healing is complete and instantaneous in chapter 10. So then that gives you, if you look over the page, we've got a little diagram here. It's beginning to put it all together. So the chapter 1, verse 1 is called Mark's confession. Then we have Peter's confession, Centurion's confession. We have Anarian's confession, which is, I nicked this diagram from Sachi and Tim. But there you go. And here we're beginning, if you like, to begin to put all these pieces together in a diagram, trying to think, how does it fit? And so when we see that second healing of the blind man, we think that is so alike what happens in chapter 8. It's so like what Mark has been trying to do. He wants us to see, perceive, understand who the Christ is. Well, we think, what could be the significance of that? And now, again, we could split into groups, but I think I'll just talk us through it. And you look in that middle section and you think, well, what's Mark trying to do? And that is maybe where it's clearest that he's got a pattern going on. Because you have those repeated passion predictions, we call them, where Jesus says, the Son of Man must suffer, die, and rise again. He says three times. And you clearly realise it's a section. And it's an on-the-way section, bounded, if you like, by these two healing miracles of the blind man. And so you get that on the way. And obviously you ask then, well, on the way where? And then you begin to see, well, the first half of the gospel largely happens up north, and particularly in Galilee, in the region up there. So again, if you were reading a novel, you'd be paying attention to where it was happening, clearly. And so we would do the same in Mark's gospel. So we're up there, then Jesus is on the way, and then the second half largely happens in Jerusalem, until, of course, that little Galilee pops up at the end. But you've got Galilee, on the way, Jerusalem. So you think, okay, so it looks like this is what he's doing. Mark is putting a structure together. He wants us to see it like this, with this turning point, if you like, in the middle. And we could add another confession, because when do people's eyes open? When do they see? So we've had Peter's confession and the centurion's confessions. So we might think, well, what's the reason that we get a blind man eyes opened at the end of chapter 10? And of course, before that, we just get the very previous verse, Mark 10:45, which if it was in the test, would be too easy, because we could all tell us what that is. Who shall I pick on? Where's Phil Hudson? I think he would know. Phil, Mark 10:45. Thank you. So that middle section where clearly Jesus has turned on his way, we get a lot in that section, and it ends with that Jesus' confession, if you like, the explanation, the summary, this is what it's all about. Then a blind man sees. And it's all this section on the way. Okay, so we're beginning to think, we can begin, now we've got an idea. So now we'll go into Mark this year knowing first half in Galilee, building up to Christ, this on the way section, then the other miracle, and then in Jerusalem. Okay, but still we're thinking, well, but what's the difference between the two halves? What are they about? Why is Mark splitting them like this? It's good to notice he's done it, but what's he thinking? Okay, and the first proposal that you'll often hear, so people will often suggest Mark 1 to 8 is about who is Jesus, Mark 9 to 16 is about why has he come. And as an initial proposal, that's okay. But if you think about it, as we will more and more, you'll realise that's a very basic starting point. Now, here's a caveat. Any summary, you can always pick holes in. So any that I give you, or Andrew or Tim, you'll be able to say, oh, but what about this bit? So that's not what we're trying to do. We are trying to do an overall summary for a section. But that's very simple on who is Jesus, why did he come? You quickly realise is pretty unsatisfactory. Problems come pretty fast. So in the first half of Mark's Gospel, as we'll see from now till whenever it is, February, we get lots about why Jesus came. So we don't really want to be thinking in terms of that doesn't come till later. And of course, we'll get to the second half and we'll get quite a lot about who Jesus is, his identity. And obviously, the declaration on the cross is, surely this is the Son of God. It's a declaration of identity. So we don't really want to say the identity is in the first half. But it's not, you know, it's a very basic starting point. So we'll think, okay, but we want to try and improve on it. And now I'm going to show you just how I've done it. Now, if you keep going with that structure, and the key thing I think is that three, from the three passion predictions, that shows you Mark quite likes things in threes. And as lots of people have thought about it some more, he does other things in threes. He gives little markers in threes. And if you look on the last sheet, the passages on the left, 1:16 to 4:34, there are three little sections there by the sea. And the next section, there are three sections crossing the sea. Then we get the three passion predictions. And then in 11 to 13, it's all about the temple, but there seems to be three stages where Mark tells us where Jesus is in relation to the temple. Now, I don't expect you to take that on board or to accept it or to understand it, but lots of people have seen, Mark seems to have carried on this structure elsewhere. So that's why we've got the sections there. And it's worth saying, therefore, that's the sections we use in Mark this year. We have our review studies, and we'll review those sections. And then it's worth kind of thinking through what each section is about. And there's kind of, if you like, an initial proposal from me. Notice each section, I said, is about the king. So there's lots in each section about how we should respond and implicate other things. But I've just put here, if you like, what we learn about the king. And it's the summary, and it's what I think is at the heart of this little section and what drives it. So I think that first section, 1:16-4:34, the king with authority to forgive. Notice straight away that tells us why Jesus came, to forgive. But it's focusing our attention on that one thing. And again, the second one, 4:35-8:30, to my mind, that's the king who redeems the nations. But again, it's the king and what he does, this work of redemption. If you don't quite know why I'm saying that, it'll all, I hope, come clearer as we go through, the king who redeems the nations. But then we get this turning point, what Mark has said, marker, halfway, carry on. And there's a summary, the king who suffers and serves. And then you could go on, the king who is raised to rule. And so then as I think about it, that's why he's done it. It begins to help me see what he is doing in each half. So the first half, if you like, so how would I sum up the first half? I might say something like, the first half is about who is Jesus and why he came. And I would say he's the king with authority to forgive and to redeem. So if you like my answer, my headline thinking is that. The king with authority to forgive and redeem. That's why he has come. So then, if that's what the first half is about, what's the second half doing? Why is it there? And if you like, it's the how. So the first half, put very simply, is the who is he and why has he come? Second half, how? So if you like, the second half is the question of the second half. Well, you've told me who Jesus is and why he's come. He's the king who will forgive and redeem. Then the second half especially shows me the king who suffers and serves and is raised to rule. So how will all that Jesus has shown us in 1 to 8 he will do be achieved? And the second half shows us. So how does that then help us? So that's a bit of structure. So you could, you know, chat further, refine those ideas. But if you've got something like that in mind, how does that help us? Well, think of Mark 8, verse 30 again. He strictly told them not to tell anyone about him. Why would Jesus say that? Why would Mark record it actually a number of times? Well, clearly everything we read in the first half of the gospel is true. But we're not yet in a position to explain how Jesus will achieve that. So at the moment, it's a way for Mark and Jesus saying it's not yet ready to go public. In that there is a key thing you have to understand. So Mark has a burden. He wants us to realise something that is so core to the good news. Wait till you've understood that before it certainly is time to then go and tell the world. And he's focused our attention particularly on these middle chapters, 8 to 10. So if you like, if you use language of turning point or key or heart of the book, these are it, chapters 8 to 10. He wants us to, and you've got the blindness either side, he wants us to understand chapters 8 to 10 before we are in a position to really grasp what he's on about. And those are very hard chapters. I don't mean hard in the academic way, in the way that hard to put together. There's all that excitement in the first half of the gospel. Jesus is clearly an amazing king, astonishing authority, great power to do much good. And people love that. Of course they do. We do. That's right. That's true. But simply to think that is not actually to know who Jesus is. Because although there are clues in the first half, what Mark wants us to realise is Jesus is a king who achieves all that and he has come to suffer and to serve. And that is a shock. And that is where we see everyone dropping away or beginning to. That's where the opposition rises. He's a king who's come to suffer and serve. And Mark really wants us to understand, you don't understand who Jesus is until you've understood that. A king who came to suffer and to serve. And it's more than that. It's not just understanding. He wants us to think that's why Jesus is great. Jesus is not great despite his cross, despite the fact that he suffered and died, as if that was just simply something to get through and you've got greatness on the other side. It's in these chapters that Jesus talks about greatness and he says it is to be last of all. Jesus is telling us, isn't he? And then he says he has come to be a ransom for many. He's come to serve all people. He is saying in chapters 8 to 10, I am the greatest. Because I come to suffer, to serve, and to die. That is one of the hardest things to get our heads around, that is the kind of king we have, and that is a great thing. That's the kind of king we need, what that shows us about him and who he is. And of course, once we get that, the rest of Mark will make sense. We'll realise he is the greatest king we could possibly imagine because he did that. That's his identity. And that's why the second confession comes at the cross. Others say, get Jesus off the cross, we'll see and believe. No, no, the centurion gets it. It's at the cross. That is God's king. He's not God's king somewhere else. He's not God's king, if you like, when he's just doing amazing miracles. There he is. That's where we see God's king. And you see, once we've understood that, once that's in place, the rest will follow. Mark wants us to serve. We'll only do that if we realise that we follow a fantastic king who's fantastic because he served. Mark calls us to suffer. We'll only do that if we realise that we're like our king and in our world that's what it meant for him. He had to suffer. Mark wants us to speak the good news without a doubt. He wants us to actually to lose our life for Jesus and the gospel. But you'll only do that when you know what the gospel is, which is a crucified king. And we all do it. We just don't talk about Jesus, do we? Because we know we're going to suffer. We all do it all the time. And Mark is wanting to say, that is what's going to happen, but that's what's meant to happen. That's what will happen. Look at Jesus. So speak of him and don't cut out the cross. Speak of the Jesus who died. And that will mean taking up your cross and following him. So all that will come, but it's important that we realise Mark has a structure. He's ordered it. He wants us to think why he has done that. And especially wants us to draw our attention to Jesus, of course, all the way through. He is the king, but his identity is he's the king who suffers. Let me pray, and then I think there is time for questions, but let me pray first. Father, thank you so much again for Mark's gospel. Thank you for the privilege we have this year of hearing it, of thinking about it, of being confused by it, of wrestling with it. We do pray that as we do that, you would give us more insight. You'd help us to reflect on it. And so as you've promised, that you would give us insight. And we pray you'd help us as we begin to piece it together to understand why he has written it. But not just so that we can come up with statements or anything like that, but so that we can see what it is you want to tell us about your son, so that we will love and adore him all the more and long with your help to follow in the way. In Jesus' name, amen. So I think we have got a few minutes now, Tim. We can chat for a few minutes. Any questions about any of that, what I did, how that'll help us this year? Johnny?
This is just in English, when we in school, when we analyse books, it seemed like sometimes we were just playing games with the text.
Yeah.
And spotting all these things, which are great fun to spot, but it just felt like a bit of a game. I mean, and some of it seemed really spurious and unreasonable, but that's what you have to do. But I mean, is it because this is written by, you know, God wrote it through Mark? Is it safer to do that? I mean, how do we know we're not going too far in our...
Which is a brilliant question. The last thing we want to do is to go beyond the text. But it's clear, as you know, as we study it, Mark has written this very, very carefully. And we could discuss the ways of writing narrative in those days. They wouldn't have chapters and verses. They wouldn't have an introductory contents page. They would put in markers in the text to show you these things. That's how narrative was written back then. But at the same time, the more you reflect and dwell on it, you can see that clearly there is some intention. And that's why I got you to do that exercise. If I just say, look at this word that pops up here, there and there, I think you'd be rightfully sceptical, or at least want to say, no, you know, show me more of that. But that's why I think when we start out trying to work all this out, the key is to look, what has Mark made really obvious? And I hope you can see that he's clearly trying to do something with the beginning, the middle and the end. And he's given us, if you like, lots and lots of pointers. He's clearly wanting you to think, these are key points in Mark's gospel, in what I've written. And so pull together all the evidence. And that's why I said slightly, look for the ones that are really obvious. And then, if you like, the ones you're not sure about, well, probably there'll be a few of those to back up the main one. If it's just something you think, well, maybe, maybe not, I would say don't worry about it. You know, notice it, forget it. But there are so many things in Mark that are really obvious. You can go with those. Paul?
Looking at this way you've structured it, it's really helped me understand what this whole temptation section is about, 1 to 15. When we're with our groups and we just look at that little block, are we allowed to bring in the whole of Mark in order to help understand what kind of weird things are going on?
Do we draw in all of this that we've been amazed by and got really excited by in our first week in Mark in a week's time? And the answer is no, really, at least in the early weeks. So I'd encourage you and I to do as much work as we can, to think it all through. And it's not that it's not benefiting the study. It's giving us, I hope, greater conviction. And any study you lead, you could take it so many different ways. But getting this big picture in place will show you the way to take it, which I will be clear from that one passage, but you won't do all the working and show the scaffolding, and you won't get excited and say, we'll see this so many times. In the early weeks, can I encourage you, in the first few weeks, do this work, be convinced in your own mind, but then teach really simply from the passage you've got. We've had a weekend away. You, I hope, have read it loads of times over the summer. That won't happen, sadly, in 10 days' time. They'll come cold. Show them what you know is here because you've thought about it, but just show them what's in the first few passages. As the year goes on, who knows? Groups may be able to see more and want to, but take it easy.
Very similar, so...
Okay, yeah. Anything else? Great. Who am I handing over to? Tim or Tim? This is Tim.
Great, okay. There'll be coffee in a minute, but just a couple of things from me.